I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now from St. Paul, where it's back to the business of electing John McCain president. Last night, they started the speeches, and really, the convention really got rolling. Let's listen.
I know the hard choices that fall solely to a president. John McCain's life has prepared him to make those choices. He is ready to lead this nation.
The Democrats present a history-making nominee for president. History-making in that he's the most liberal, most inexperienced nominee to ever run for president.
I appeal to independents, Democrats, and Republicans. Let's come together this November to make a great American patriot, John McCain, our next great president.
Democrat and Senator Joe Lieberman, before him Fred Thompson, former senator, and of course President Bush via satellite, began our montage there. On the agenda tonight, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. He's going to give the convention's keynote address, and of course the most anticipated event of the evening, Vice Presidential nominee Sarah Palin's speech, perhaps the most anticipated moment of the week outside of John McCain's speech tomorrow night. John Harwood is with us, CNBC chief Washington correspondent and New York Times political writer. And, John, it felt as if the gloves came off last night, maybe even more than some analysts expected.
They did to some degree. I have to disagree with you on one thing, though, Robin. I think Sarah Palin's address tonight may be the most anticipated event of the week.
I wanted to be respectful of the candidate.
No, you were. But I think this is part of the problem for John McCain. His team did not anticipate the way in which Sarah Palin would, in effect, take over the entire storyline of the convention. And that's one of the reasons why there wasn't that much attention paid last night to the speeches by Lieberman, Fred Thompson, George W. Bush. But you did see the attempt to begin to try to define Barack Obama, which is something the McCain team desperately needs to do.
Well, I want to ask you one thing while you bring this up. Just a little while ago this morning, the McCain campaign held a conference call in which they said that Palin went through the exact vetting process as all the other candidates, answering all the 70 questions on the questionnaire, but that McCain did not know about her daughter's pregnancy until the day before the announcement. What does that say about Sarah Palin, perhaps, as a candidate, as a politician, that she didn't early on, very early on, say to the campaign, we have this issue too?
I think what it says to me about Sarah Palin is that she's a human being, she's a parent. I don't think any parent would naturally want to bring out this information that might be painful and embarrassing for a teenager. I can only imagine what Bristol Palin is going through right now. And I think, she did bring it out at the end of the day, but I'm not sure that that's what you would make first in your conversation list.
Well, maybe even midway, you know, maybe even before the last day, and not assigning it any, you know, pejorative, but just letting your running mate know.
Well, fair enough. But remember, Robin, that she only had her vetting interview the day before she was offered the job. So clearly this process, there was an initial process where John McCain met her, spent some time with her, but this was a backloaded selection process.
Okay. A little more from what we heard last night. Fred Thompson delivered a ringing defense of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. The CNN commentators were saying they're not sure he'd actually met her. But he also made a comment about the Democrats. And your thoughts on this? He said, yes, they had a wonderful, historic convention. He paused a beat. They elected the most liberal and most inexperienced candidate. Now, that might seem as a real slap at African Americans who might have expected a comment at the Republican convention about the historic nomination of the first African American. Only 40 African American delegates here in St. Paul compared to over 1,000 in Denver. Was that perhaps a misstep?
Well, I think you might have written that paragraph a little bit more deftly to include a nod to that, because remember, after all, John McCain ran an advertisement congratulating Barack Obama the night he was nominated on having made history. But the rest of the comment is consistent with the Republican attack. They're trying to say that Barack Obama is too inexperienced to be president, which is part of the problem with the Sarah Palin nomination. It's undercutting the argument that they were bringing against Barack Obama with some success during the summer.
Okay, and I want to ask you about Senator Joe Lieberman's speech. He was warmly welcomed here, considers himself a Democrat, registered independent. He made a plea to Democrats to vote for John McCain. Now, this is anecdotal, but our colleague Steph Katsonis's electrician's wife, who had been an Obama supporter, changed her vote after hearing Joe Lieberman speak of John McCain, she said, "I didn't really understand who he was until they told me."
Well, it's always effective in American politics to have someone from the other team embrace what you're doing, because it doesn't happen very often. We have very polarized parties. You don't have very many Republican senators supporting the Democratic nominee or vice versa. And I think that's one of the elements that gives power to what Joe Lieberman had to say, just as it did for Zell Miller 4 years ago against John Kerry. Zell Miller had given a keynote for Bill Clinton in 1992. He comes and attacks John Kerry. Joe Lieberman was milder in his remarks about Barack Obama, but nonetheless, the fact that he was on the Democratic ticket just 8 years ago and was saying, no, this year you need to support the Republican nominee, that has some juice to it if the American people were listening. That's one of the questions.
John Harwood, CNBC's chief Washington correspondent, New York Times political writer as well. John, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, have you noticed that the conversation at both presidential conventions has been largely about one woman, Hillary Clinton in Denver, Sarah Palin here in St. Paul? What does it say about women in politics that they're dominating the debate? And what will Sarah Palin have to say tonight to move that debate from her daughter to her running mate? The Wall Street Journal reports today that the GOP is scrambling to control the public conversation over Palin, canceling her public appearances. And a new poll from USA Today shows Barack Obama pulling ahead of John McCain among registered voters, up from a 4-point lead before the Democratic convention to something like an 11-point lead now. Of course, after Sarah Palin speaks tonight, that may all change. Joining us, Ellen Goodman, Pulitzer Prize-winning Boston Globe syndicated columnist, a veteran observer of politics and how they intersect or don't with women's issues. She is joining us from the Northeast. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have Diana Bannister sitting with us here in St. Paul. She's a Republican strategist, deputy political director on Pat Buchanan's presidential campaign in 1996. Also a delegate from Virginia and joins us, as we said, right here. Thank you so much, Diana. And Ellen, I just want to start with you first. Just the overall picture. Is this a bottleneck for women, you know, two women being so dissected? Or is it a breakthrough for women that they are dominating the conversation?
I think that the drama is incredible. And for better and for worse, the conversation has shifted from what we might loosely refer to as issues to a kind of personal narrative. And this is not exactly what the women's movement slogan meant when we used to say the personal is political. I mean, the political has become incredibly personal in both of these cases.
Well, turning to Diana, Sarah Palin was introduced to Americans just last Friday, to most Americans,
right,
as the family values candidate. And to many, that means no sex before marriage. And so now we have this drama, which is a very personal drama and you know, an emotional one for many Americans to see it played out in the Palin family.
Right.
But the right has connected problems like teen pregnancy with loose morals and liberal values. So is there perhaps an hypocrisy here that now they are rushing to embrace this woman and maybe not a young, pregnant teen mom from the south side of Chicago?
Well, it is an example of what happens in families all across the country, and I think that that's what makes Sarah Palin so interesting and so exciting for this convention, because she is a typical American. Things happen in families, and we have all experienced it. We have to deal with it the way, you know, we usually don't have to deal with it in front of the national spotlight,
right,
but it's an issue, and I don't think it's hypocrisy. It is actually we're all flawed human beings, and that's why people have embraced her, understanding that this happens in families.
Well, but Ellen, the right and many Republicans, and we've heard it here, are blaming the left and the media for making Sarah Palin's daughter an issue, but you write it's the Republicans that made the issue of teen pregnancy a wedge issue.
Well, it's the Republicans who tried to take over the mantle of, quote, family values. And by family values, they did not mean that we all live in very complicated families where parents have to make decisions on their own with their children. What they meant, certainly, was that abstinence until marriage is the only way to go, and that it's not the family that makes the decision about whether a teenage daughter should carry a child to term. It's the government that makes that decision. And also, let's remember that John McCain has been a little dicey even on contraception. So the Republican Party put this subject smack in the middle of the debate.
Diane, I want to just I just want to ask Diana here in St. Paul. I heard last night on, you know, late last night on CNN, maybe it was early this morning, a so-called hip-hop Republican, a young black man, who said, you know, I just think our party made a mistake in positioning Sarah Palin as such a family values candidate in an attempt to get the core conservative of the base. They should have positioned her as an administrator, as someone who's run a state and a city. That should have been top of mind as opposed to, you know, maybe a little bit below family values. And then we wouldn't be there. Then there wouldn't be a charge of hypocrisy.
Well, I think what they tried to position her is they were going for the disaffected Hillary voter. Now, you think about that disaffected Hillary voter who's charge is that the Democratic Party, you know, overlooked the most experienced woman for the new fresh male face. And they were trying to get that voter by going for the new fresh female face. I mean, the inexperienced, the epitome of an inexperienced
nominee. I'm going to let Diana in here. Let's let Diana in here on just, you know, did the party make a mistake in leaning too much on something that would please the conservative core?
The family values candidate is someone who welcomes life, whether it's her Down syndrome child or it's her daughter who got pregnant at a very young age. She welcomes life. She embraces her daughter, does not take her out to take another choice. She brings life into the world gladly and supportive of the whole family is wrapped around this young girl, helping her to make this decision, not taking her to an abortion clinic, not taking her somewhere where she could get some advice.
Well, on the other hand, Diane and Ellen, I want to ask you this. I was in the mall last night, Mall of America, here in Minnesota, and I met a young girl behind the counter who is a single mom. She lives in public housing that Minnesota has to help mothers. It's a lower rent. It has daycare for her. She said that Republican volunteers came to work to volunteer yesterday in her public housing, and she thought that was interesting because she hadn't felt embraced by Republicans before. I'm just wondering, Ellen, we only have a minute. We'll pick it up on the other side of a break, but might this be a point where, in fact, the right and the left might actually merge a little bit on the issue of teen moms, where they hadn't in the past?
Well, I don't think that there has been a huge amount of judgment against teenage moms from the left. I think that teenagers have been, the left has said that a pregnant teenager should make this decision about her life. I think one of the things that's confusing about the Sarah Palin issue in terms of her mothering is, did she not realize that she was offering up her 17-year-old pregnant daughter into the media maw to become and dissected as a kind of another Jamie Lynn Spears?
Well, Ellen Goodman,
that is one of the things that's troubling, too.
Ellen Goodman, Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist. We're also speaking with Diana Bannister, a Republican strategist and also a delegate here in St. Paul. Let's pick that up on the other side. Some are saying that because of her daughter's situation, maybe she shouldn't have run. But is that unfair? Would we have asked the same question of a man? So let's pick that up when we come back. We'll be back in just 1 minute here and now. I'm Robin Young in St. Paul at the Republican National Convention. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about the fact that women are dominating the conversation at both conventions, but of course we're looking at one woman in particular today because she's going to speak tonight. That's Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, John McCain's running mate. Now, Ellen Goodman, syndicated columnist of the Boston Globe, joins us from the Northeast, and she was just commenting on, you know, should Sarah Palin have known, realized that she was going to be putting her daughter in this media maw, was the phrase you used, Ellen, great phrase, by becoming John McCain's running mate. And Diana Bannister is here with us as well, and a delegate and a Republican strategist. What do you think about people who have questioned whether or not Sarah Palin should even have run, given a family crisis?
Well, I can't even imagine that she had any anticipation that the mainstream media would go crazy over this issue. Usually in a family as Senator Obama said, should be sort of off limits. I don't think that she realized at the time that it would come to be such a huge issue.
But wait a second. This is a woman who, as governor, said that she is against sex education in schools, only for abstinence as a form of birth control. You know, she has made it an issue. I mean, this is something that,
as I said, she welcomes her daughter's choice in welcoming this child into life. And I think that's the key that she, all I can say is she has energized this convention like nothing I have ever seen. I've been to the last five conventions. She is a candidate, and she's an accomplished woman. You know, we all have struggles. Women have to make choices, very, very difficult choices. When she was offered the opportunity to serve her country by Senator McCain, I think she welcomed the opportunity as not just a woman, but as someone who is accomplished in her own state. I mean, if we want to talk about some of the things that she's worked on, if the Democrats want to talk about big oil, she took on big oil. She took on people in her own state who were corrupt. She
in
has
her own
done,
party.
In her own party.
But let me let Ellen Goodman jump in here. Ellen, you know, you were talking about whether she thought about putting her daughter in the mall. You know, there's been conversation about whether or not she, as a mother of five with a Down syndrome child, never mind a grandchild on the way, should even run. Do you think that's fair?
No. I do think you asked the question about whether I would have asked the same or people would be asking the same thing if she were a man, if a father would have been criticized for exposing a 17-year-old daughter to this kind of incredible attention, up to and including, you know, the MySpace profile of the father of the child. And I do think that if I would have certainly held a father to the same thought process, have asked, questioned whether he had thought that through before it came about. Now, the right wing has this fascinating and tremendous problem that they, on the one hand, oppose, sex before marriage. On the other hand, they are in favor of the decision to carry the pregnancies, which seems so that they are caught.
Which is why last night,
caught on the whole, caught in the middle of their own politics. Wait, they're not in favor of having.
Well, which had Ellen, the if you would have, Ellen, if you would have seen the whole convention last night, they also talked a lot about adoption. Cindy McCain and John McCain adopted, of course, a young baby from Bangladesh, I believe,
yes,
and brought two children who were in dire straits, starved, had nothing on them. They brought them over to this country and adopted them. That's fine.
I want to get one last thing in here because each side is accusing the other of making this a wedge issue, but someone has definitely thrown down a gauntlet, and that's Phyllis Schlafly. She's national leader of the conservative Eagle Forum. She was speaking yesterday on our sister program, On Point, talking about Governor Palin's infant son who has Down syndrome. Let's listen.
If Sarah Palin were a Democrat, she would have aborted the baby. That's the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. And Sarah Palin demonstrated that she is pro-life in contra to all of the Democrats.
Diana, is that fair? The host of that program, Tom Ashbrook, has had a brother who's Down syndrome, and hundreds of his outraged listeners, Democrat and Republican, are saying, what are you saying? Of course Democrats keep and raise Down syndrome children. And of course, Republicans might make a choice not to. I mean, that, you talk about wedge politics, there it is right there.
Well, as I said, I think the decision by Governor Palin and her husband to have the baby is significant. The way they've wrapped their arms around their daughter and supported her in her decision making. As I said,
but is
women,
it fair to wrap your arms around it in a way that says that only Republicans do that, only Republicans choose to have their children, and that somehow,
no, as I said, and Governor Palin is an example of this. We all have difficult decisions in our families, in our lives. She's an example of a woman who's had several crises and has endured them and succeeded in her state, has done exceptionally well. I'm again, I think she's surprised at the amount of attention this has received.
Ellen, I'm going to give you a few seconds.
Well, I'm not surprised at the amount of attention, and the McCain campaign shouldn't have been surprised. But, you know, we all do have difficult decisions. But the thing about the Sarah Palin's politics, if we can get back to that, is her position, for example, on the issue of abortion is to the right of John McCain's. So those decisions, she doesn't believe families are capable of making. She doesn't believe women as moral decision makers of their own.
I'm
going
to have to wrap up here. Sarah Palin believes that there should be no abortion, even in when it comes to the health of the mother. Well, we are all going to hear Sarah Palin speaking tonight. Diana Bannister, a Republican strategist, deputy political director of Pat Buchanan's presidential campaign in 1996,
Can I add one more thing?
No, you can't.
We're excited to see her tonight. We're very energized about
it. Sorry about that, Ellen. You know, we have these built-in breaks we have to get to because stations will be left with dead air if we don't. But she'll be cheering. Ellen Goodman, we're going to have you back as you are a frequent guest on Here and Now and get a look at what Sarah Palin did say. Ellen Goodman is, of course, syndicated columnist based in Boston with the Boston Globe. I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Certainly one of the most interesting conventions anyone can remember. Two of them in a row, in fact, and we'll be back with more coverage after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now in St. Paul, Minnesota, where Sarah Palin's speech tonight accepting the Republican vice presidential nomination will, as we heard, be intensely scrutinized, and a team of McCain advisors is coaching her. One of them is Douglas Holtz Aiken, senior policy advisor to John McCain. Now, we spoke with him several times when he was director of the Congressional Budget Office, where he was known as a Republican not afraid of criticizing the Republican administration's handling of the ballooning budget, and he joins us now in St. Paul. Doug, welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you know, many people perceive of Sarah Palin as a relatively new pick, and I'm just wondering, you've spoken with her. What is it that you are, in a nutshell, wanting to communicate to her about what the McCain team that she's joining wants to say about the economy?
Well, the top priority is jobs for Americans, and everything that John McCain is campaigning on, his health care policy, his energy policy, his tax policy, budget policy, trade policy, is about making sure we have jobs in America. And that's the foundation of the future for the typical family.
Well, as you all know, last year John McCain told the Boston Globe that the issue of economics is not something I've understood as well as I should. You probably were
this
wincing.
This is the first time I've heard this.
And he said then also that in choosing a vice president, he'd look for a person with economic experience to compensate for his shortcomings. Then he picked Sarah Palin, mayor of a town of, you know, just around 7,000 before she was governor of a very small state, a little over 500,000 people. So what is she bringing?
Well, she brings executive experience. She has been in charge of the state of Alaska. She's been responsible for its budget, responsible for the education of children, responsible for the National Guard.
But it's not still Mitt Romney, you know, of Bain Capital, who saved the Olympics. I mean, it's economics and administration on a smaller scale. And also, Sarah Palin once eagerly sought out government spending known as earmarks pork, you know, when she was mayor in Alaska. This is before she was against them, most recently regarding the infamous Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska. Now, some were saying today, I heard Mayor Giuliani of New York say, that's what mayors do. But this is something that John McCain has been so against.
That is what mayors do, and that was the system in which she entered as a mayor. When she became governor, she had the opportunity and took it to change that system. And she cut down on the earmark request by the state to the federal government, and she also vetoed the special projects within the state of Alaska. That's the kind of record that John McCain is looking for.
Just staying with Sarah Palin for a second, the McCain campaign just held a conference call in which they said that she was vetted like all the other candidates.
Correct.
There's a huge 70-question questionnaire. But how does that square with reports that we've heard that the campaign is saying that John McCain found out about her daughter's pregnancy only the day before? Weren't questions about sex and drugs and things like that in the vetting process?
There's a multi-step vetting process. Senator had the same process for every candidate, but obviously you wouldn't want to have what are, quite frankly, some very tough and personal questions imposed on every candidate. Unless they're going to be a finalist.
What does it say about Sarah Palin that in Ask Those Questions, and we have to guess that one of them was, is there anything we should know? she didn't say until the day before to John McCain that she had a teen pregnancy in her family. What does that say about her as a candidate?
Number one, she told the senator prior to the decision that's the right thing to do.
But the
number
day
two,
before.
He made the decision to have her as the running mate. And quite frankly, she went through the same vetting process as everybody, answered the questions appropriately as everyone did, and was selected to be the running mate.
Let's talk about John McCain's policies and you as his or one of his economic advisors. Our memory is that you're the guy who raised a lot of flags about the Bush administration's tax cut program. As you watched the budget balloon, we had you on the program, and you said it was actually kind of hard to be a Republican and be the one saying that the tax cuts, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, were unsustainable. You also said even eliminating the tax cuts would be just a finger in the dike, I think is the way you put it. But, you know, you got a lot of heat from the party because you were flagging the budget is out of control. What are you doing with John McCain, the guy who now he was against tax cuts and now he's for them?
He is, first and foremost, the leading critic of spending in Washington. And we have a spending problem in the federal government. Now, the same reason I said the tax cuts were just a finger in the dike is because it's a spending problem. Once you spend the money, you're going to have to pay for it one way or another. And John McCain is committed to doing the things that are necessary to control spending and in the process bring the deficit under control. There are really three steps
that
are
important. But how's he going to do that? If he keeps the tax cuts, he satisfies the supply-siders who want money, you know, out in the economy so people spend it. But he's not going to satisfy those hawks, those fiscal hawks, who want to cut. I mean, how does it work?
Number one, it's important to recognize that he has never voted to raise income taxes in his entire career. So for him to not want to raise taxes in 2010 is entirely consistent with his past positions. To be successful with the federal budget right now, the first ingredient has to be a growing economy. We have never had an episode of successful deficit reduction when the economy wasn't growing. So first step is keep the economy going, and it's got to go better than it's going right now. Raising taxes wouldn't help that. Second step, you've got to control spending. The discretionary part, roughly a third of the budget, we need to put the defense and the non-defense in the mix and really scrub it from one end to the other. He's committed to doing that. But the budget will stay but balanced only as soon as we do major entitlement reforms, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So,
he'll make cuts in social programs? We've heard other economists, David Walker, former comptroller, who has left government and is now crusading to tell people that we are going to have to cut Social Security. There are going to be people above a certain income, older people, certain savings even, who are not going to get benefits. We're going to have to start making hard cuts. Will John McCain make hard cuts?
Well, the Social Security program, you can bring the promised benefits down into alignment with the payroll taxes by slowing the growth of benefits, not actually cutting it, just slowing the growth, particularly at the upper end.
People get them later in life?
You can do it either by changing the formula, you can change retirement ages, you can change indexing. There's a large menu of ways to get it done. But the primary objective should be to get everyone in a bipartisan way to agree that this is a problem that can be solved, should be solved, and as we wait, it gets harder, not easier.
Well, we want to end where we began. You say John McCain really wants to concentrate and wants Sarah Palin to concentrate on jobs. Recently, former Senator Phil Graham, who was an economic advisor, as you are, a friend, said that the country had become a nation of whiners about the economy. It wasn't in a real recession, but the country was in a mental recession. He left the campaign, but is this language about jobs now to offset that? Does the McCain campaign see that, as apparently Phil Graham didn't, there is real pain in this country, or do you think that there's some whining going on?
Senator McCain is in better touch with the American people than any other politician. He campaigns in town halls. He's regularly engaged with Americans and their problems, and he never shared Senator Graham's views and why he now considers him a candidate for the ambassador to Belarus. That's an appropriate place for those kinds of comments. They're not Senator McCain's view of the way America feels right now.
Douglas Holtz Aiken, senior policy advisor to John McCain, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. You better watch out. You might end up in Belarus. You made the wrong comment. Douglas, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Protesters took to the streets of St. Paul outside the RNC again last night. The police again used a form of spray to break up the crowd. Only 10 were arrested. Monday, nearly 300 were arrested in a protest. Sharif Kudus and Nicole Salazar, producers from the public radio program Democracy Now!, were covering Monday's protest when Salazar filmed her own arrest.
Yeah.
Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman heard of the arrests and ran to the scene where she was also arrested. We spoke with Amy after they were all later released and asked, did her crew have their credentials on? Were they clearly press?
Everyone. We have, you know, I have it like I'm having it now, like they have it. We hold them out. We always wear them, our credentials. Our videographer, Nicole, she's holding up her press pass. She's holding her very clear camera, and they are moving her back, which she is doing, but she's trapped against a parked car. They tell her to get her face on the ground. She's pushed to the ground. They put a boot on between her shoulder blades, and another one is pulling her leg, and they're telling her to keep her face on the ground. She's arrested. Sharif is right there. They throw him up against a wall. They put him in handcuffs, hands behind his back. He is kicked in the chest twice. A little while later, I come running down the street from the convention. I just go up to the line of riot police. Who's your commanding officer? My producer's inside. I need to make sure that they're released. They grab me, pull me through the line.
You have your credentials on.
Not only do I have my regular credentials, I've come from the convention floor. I've got my jacket on. I've got my high security clearance radio TV that allows me onto the convention floor. So I'm holding it up. I'm saying, guys, I am press. I never get my jacket back. They pull that away. And I say, look, I've got my security. I've got my top security clearance. So the Secret Service comes over. We're being arrested by Minneapolis police. The Secret Service comes over. They rip the credential away and they take it. I said, I demand a receipt for that. Of course, they don't give it to me. But I still have my other credential. They put me in the police wagon. Nicole is there. We're brought to the jail. I'm let out after a couple of hours on a misdemeanor charge.
What's your misdemeanor? What's your charge?
They say interfering with a peace officer.
Did you ever put your hands on a police officer? Did you ever block anything?
I mean, it's so well videotaped. And Nicole filmed her own arrest, so you see everything that happened. She's shouting, press, press. And as she goes down, she is screaming because this hurts.
Amy Goodman, what are you going to do now? The two producers also have charges against them.
We're going to see what happens. They face PC riot, which is probable cause riot. That is a felony. I face misdemeanor. I demanded to know of Chief Harrington, are they dropping the charges? And he said they're investigating.
Amy, just a couple questions to you. First of all, what do you say to people who might be saying, look, it was a confusing scene. I saw it on television.
There was anarchists
there.
Confusing about this. The police had full control of the area at this point. When I come up to the riot police line, there was not anything else happening.
Okay, someone who says everybody's got videography now, everybody's got a camera,
We have credentials and we have high security credentials to get onto the convention floor. But, you know, you're raising an interesting point, which is no one should be treated like this. I mean, when the police chief said we caught the criminals, we've got 300 of them behind bars, I now have to ask, who exactly does he have behind bars? Because I know who three of them are, and me and my two producers.
One last question. The same thing I asked Medea Benjamin of Code Pink in Denver. With two wars being waged, with a struggling economy, wages flat, CEOs from government-backed companies like Freddie Mac walking away with $90 million bonuses, why aren't there more protesters?
Just being in the streets is one form of protest. People are doing it every which way. Librarians are saying no to the USA Patriot Act. Scientists are talking about global warming as the Bush administration is vacuuming the words global warming off of government websites. And the big untold story is the level of resistance within the military, from the low-level grunts to the generals saying no to war.
You are a journalist. As you told the police you were a journalist, you have a... You are credentialed, but what do you say to people who say, but you're an activist?
That's why we were put in jail. That's why we're in prison. That's why Nicole was thrown to the ground. I think journalists are very important because they are the watchdog on democracy. But that doesn't mean we're the only ones who should be protected. Everyone should.
Amy Goodman from Public Radio's Democracy Now! Coming up, from All the King's Men to America, America, books for the season, here and now.
It is your right that every child should have a complete education, that any man who produces anything can take it to market without paying toll, and no poor man's land or farm can be taxed or taken away from him. And it is the right of the people that they shall not be deprived of hope.
I'm Robin Young in St. Paul. It's Here and Now, and though it might sound like it, that was not a scene from a political convention. It's actually from the 1949 film All the King's Men. Roderick Crawford won an Oscar for his portrayal of the Louisiana demagogue, Willie Stark. Of course, before it was a film, All the King's Men was a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Robert Penn Warren. Recently, we asked Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr for his picks for political films to watch. We also thought we'd turn to hero now literary critic Steve Almond for a reading list. But first, we want to be specific when we say political reads, because there's fiction and then there's political memoir.
Yeah, I mean, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting one of these books about by a former administration official or a pundit, an ex-reporter. But I'm interested in an artist's take, the kind of long view of politics. So, for instance, All the King's Men, it might be based on the life of Huey P. Long, and the People magazine version of it would sort of try to draw all the lines between those two characters, the fictional character and the real-life cognate. But it's really a book about the pursuit of power and how that warps populism into demagoguery. That's the long view version of it. That's what makes it a piece of art. And that's the kind of book I love.
Now, I presume you'd read it in the past and, you know...
17 times straight.
That's what I was going to say. You have read it more than once. I mean, it really pulls you in.
Yeah, it's... Really, these books are about, if you think of politics in American life, it's become sport, but it's also our aristocracy. It's the great drama of power played out before the commoners. And in this case, any enduring piece of fiction or nonfiction has absolutely unforgettable characters, and Willie Stark is it. He is the quintessential idealist who is entirely, absolute power corrupts him absolutely, and he also is just an unbelievably eloquent speaker. The speeches in this book are unbelievable.
Okay, so All the King's Men from Robert Penn Warren on Steve's list. We'll have it on our website, by the way, here-now.org. From the King's Men to the President's Men, this nonfiction book that Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward wrote, their account of their reporting of the Watergate scandal in the Nixon administration. Now, I had to say, when I heard you'd pick this, I was a little surprised.
Yeah. I didn't mean to pick this book, honestly. It really picked me. I hadn't read All the President's Men, and I'll be honest, I was just kind of looking through political in the library, couldn't stop reading it. Unbelievable, best mystery ever written.
Even
and it's
though we
all
feel,
true.
We feel we know it. We feel like all the
you
President's
don't
Men.
Know it. You don't know it. And the movie version is a pale version of how this played out. Did you know, by the way, that when the Watergate plumbers, as they call them, broke into the Democratic National Committee headquarters, it was actually several weeks before the election, and Nixon was 20 points ahead of any Democratic contender. He didn't really have to do it. Part of the reason that I'm so drawn to it is that it has all this cloak and dagger stuff. But for people like me who are deeply frustrated by the media's discourse on politics, it's a kind of wish fantasy that these intrepid reporters exist and that they actually get at the levers of power. And the way that it plays out, it literally could not be more dramatic. You read, I was breathless reading it.
So set the scene for us from Woodward and Bernstein's All the President's Men.
Well, Woodward, one of his most famous source was Deep Throat. We didn't know Deep Throat's name for 30 years, actually, but in 2005 it was revealed to be then FBI Associate Director W. Mark Felt. But Deep Throat was really Woodward's most important source. And the way that they communicated, a flower pot was put on a windowsill, notes were left. So I'm going to read a little scene that captures some of the kind of delicious paranoia of their relationship. At 9 the next night, Woodward walked a few blocks before taking a cab to a section of the city in the opposite direction from the bar. He's been asked to meet. Deep Throat's asked to meet him at a bar. He walked another 15 minutes and took a cab to within a few blocks of the bar. It was really a tavern, an old wooden house, which had been converted into a saloon for truckers and construction workers. He spotted Deep Throat sitting alone at a side table and nervously sat down across from him. "Why here?" he asked. Deep Throat answered, "No chance you were followed? Two cabs and all?" So you can see what the kind of lengths they were having to go to meet with one another.
I'm looking further down the page where you're reading, Woodward took a breath. Deep Throat sipped his scotch gingerly, then wiped his mouth inelegantly with the back of his hand.
Yes.
That's a scene.
Yeah, no, and that's the reason I justified slipping this onto this list, because it's not the most dazzling prose in the world and so forth, but it is an unbelievable thriller.
Right. We want to talk about a book that's been getting a lot of attention, you know, today. It's Ethan Koenig's America, America. I love Ethan Koenig's writings, his short stories and other books. What has he done here?
It's the account of a young innocent who has to be versed in the ways of the world, the evil political world in this case. Corey Sifter is the narrator. He gets involved with the presidential campaign of a New York senator named Henry Bonwiller, who's running for president in 1972, a fictional character. Corey Sifter witnesses and sort of unwittingly takes part in a scandal that eventually brings Bonwiller down.
All right, set up this reading for us.
Well, this is really Corey Sifter and Ethan Kanan really reflecting on what he's learned essentially from being that close to the great halls of power and politics. One of the hallmarks of our politics now, Kanan writes, is that we tend to elect those who can campaign over those who can lead. It's an obvious point, but because of my history, I've spent a fair amount of time pondering what it might have meant for Henry Bonwiller. For a man on the rise in politics, power first comes through character, that combination of station and forcefulness that produces not just intimidation, which is power's crudest form, but flattery too, which is one of its more refined. After that, power begins to grow from its own essence, rising no longer exclusively from the man, but from the office itself, and this is where some balance must be found between its attainment and its allotment, between the unquenchable desire in any politician to rise and the often humbling requirement that one's station must now be used to some benefit. And here, of course, is where corruption begins, for power contains an irresistible urge to further itself. There is always the next race. And this really returns us to the idea of all the people who enter politics who are idealists, after all, and what the nature of power and having to get elected does to them.
Well, before we go, I know you have a couple more books you just want to throw out.
Quick. Mm-hmm. The Plot Against America by Philip Roth. I think it's his greatest novel, and it was, I think, way underrated. It imagines a world in which Charles Lindbergh, the great aviator and little-known anti-Semite, is actually elected president rather than FDR in 1940. And I know that sounds didactic and political, but the genius of the novel, what makes it enduring, is that it's really about how politics plays out against personal loyalties. And then another book that was actually released during the last election, a fascinating book called Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of a President. It's by Justin Frank, and it's really very much a book about how much the psychological health of a president matters and how much his personal psychological history is brought to bear in his policies. Whatever your political orientation is, totally riveting.
Okay, that's our list of political reads for this political season with Here and Now's literary critic Steve Almond, author in his own right, his latest book of essays, Not That You Asked, has just been released in paperback. Steve, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, tomorrow we'll be back here in St. Paul for a look at Sarah Palin's speech tonight and a look ahead to John McCain's speech tomorrow and our trip to the Minnesota Fair, the largest gathering of the nicest people in the world. We leave you with this thought from a native on Minnesota nice.
It's that idea that everyone smiles and is nice even if they feel awful or even if they don't like you. That's a bit disturbing, perhaps, the passive-aggressive nature of it.
Do they really say, you betcha, here?
They don't say, you betcha, but it's that, yeah. Oh, yeah. You betcha, that's going to be more the grandparents who are going to say, oh, yeah, you betcha. But no, the oh, yeah, even beautiful hipsters in uptown Minneapolis might say that. Oh, yeah, Rage Against the Machine is coming this week.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. See you from St. Paul tomorrow, Here and Now.